Welcome back to Dave's Gone By on this very special Sunday. And there's the game that people play called 6 Degrees of Kevin Bacon, where we all know the game, but you can think of any actor or perhaps any world leader or person in the world. And if you go 6 degrees somewhere, they'll be related somehow to the actor and singer Kevin Bacon. Well, it's starting to be on this program something like 6 degrees of Christine Lavin, because we had Christine on the show about a year and a half ago, wonderful singer-songwriter and a terrific person, and she's very, very much into not only promoting her own music and her own songs, but going out there and really stumping for other musicians in the folk and also occasionally the cabaret idiom. And after she appeared on Dave's Gone By, Christine was kind enough to make me like a little sampler CD of all these different people that she was listening to at the time. And one of those people was Ray Jessel, and another was Maud Maggart. And I liked the CD, and I liked Maud's stuff. And I had Ray Jessel on the program a few weeks later, and he was great. He's this older gentleman who just got into cabaret only a little while ago, and he's having the time of his life and singing these songs. And he also ended up knowing and admiring our guest tonight, Maud Maggart, because she sang with him and on several of his cabaret shows and on his CD that we played on the show. So finally I figured, you know what? This woman has such a special voice and she's so talented that we've got to keep the 6 degrees of Christine Lavin going. So ladies and gentlemen, that's a rather long intro to let you know just what a terrific and wonderful singer we have on Dave's Gone By, Maud Maggart. Hey, Maud.
Hi, Dave.
How you doing?
I'm good. I love that intro.
Thank you. I always get criticized that my intros go on longer than the actual interviews, but I promise this is going to be a tremendously long and boring interview to make up for the intro. But anyway, you're busy. You're a very busy person these days and have been for a couple of years now.
Yes.
And so how did it all really get rolling? I mean, you're in your 20s, I'm assuming?
Oh, no, I'm 32.
You're 32?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, goodness gracious. So I assume you sort of rolled into cabaret stuff right out of college, but what were you doing before?
Well, right after college, I was sort of thinking about what I wanted to do with my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I started singing. I made the decision to try my hand at getting into cabaret when I was 25. And then a year after that, a year after that, because I just turned 32, so yeah, it was about six, seven
years old. Were you working, doing like normal temp stuff or office stuff, or were you trying for something else right from the beginning?
I did a couple of little jobs, but I never got seriously into anything because nothing ever really interested me, frankly.
All right.
Which I mean, I say that because, you know, I know now that I was meant to be a singer, and so it makes sense that I was never pulled in very strongly in any other direction.
Were you a musical child? Did you take piano lessons? Did you take them willingly? That kind of thing.
I was a musical child, but I didn't take piano lessons. I taught myself how to play the guitar,
mm-hmm.
and there was always music going on around in the house where I grew up because both my parents are actors and singers.
You might as well mention that it's Brandon Maggart is your dad,
mm-hmm.
and he's, I used to see his name on Norman Lear television shows, but that's true. And I think he did Broadway as well. I mean, I may know some of this stuff, but our audience doesn't. So why don't you fill in the gaps, as it were?
Well, my father has a really extensive theater Broadway history. He in fact met my mother in the show for which he was nominated for a Tony, which was Applause.
Oh, okay.
1970.
Sorry, I couldn't hear that. 1970,
I think, was the year. But that's where he met my mother. He was nominated for Tony for playing Buzz, the playwright.
And your mom is?
My mom is Diane McAfee.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a June Taylor dancer and really a chorus girl in shows like Flora the Red Menace, which was Liza Minnelli's first show, and Superman, and I can't remember what else, but she was a chorus girl who landed the part of Eve Harrington in Applause.
Wow.
And but she did the out-of-town shows and then was replaced by Penny Fuller. And
Were you itinerant then when your folks had to go do, I guess TV was all out on the coast, but when your mom had to be doing New York and Broadway and stuff, were you moved around a lot, or did you not see your parents for weeks at a time? How did that all work?
Well, my mom really just became a mother when I was born.
Ah, okay.
And so she really, my father was the one who continued working as a performer. So he would go out of town to do things, and sometimes we would go and meet him. But I was able to, I wasn't, you know, itinerant or anything. We did stay home quite a bit and then went to meet my father, which was fun. It was fun to be a kid and be around theater and, you know.
Do you remember meeting any, like, famous people and either being really awed or meeting someone not really caring that much and then your parents told you, oh, you know, that was Ethel Merman or something like that?
I met Sammy Davis Jr. when I was very little, and all I can remember thinking was, he's really little, too. You know? Because I knew he was this famous person, but he was small, you know. And I thought that was remarkable. But that was when I was very young. I think under six.
So, it's interesting that it wasn't until 25 that you really realized, okay, music is a direction I want to go in. Because for a lot of people, it's really the teens. I mean, if you look at the whole American Idol thing, half the people there are 17 or 19. But what happened? You just began playing the guitar in what, folky clubs? And people started saying, you know, you should really take this somewhere?
No, I never played guitar for anyone. I mean, not professionally.
No, I meant going up
to the open
mic night.
So, yeah. No, actually, I was doing nothing professionally singing until I decided to get into cabaret. Throughout my teens and my brief college experience and the few years that followed, I had a paralyzing fear to try and become a singer because I was paralyzed by the fear that I might not be good, and that was just too much for me to think about. And then, you know, I got to be 25, and I thought, you know, it's this or like veterinary school, which I don't know if I can deal with. So I decided, you know what, bite the bullet, and if you fail, you fail. And I haven't, which is very good.
And worse, you can always combine them. If your voice was high enough, you could call the dogs with it. Without
I know.
Power.
Yeah. Hi, this is Maud Magart, and you're listening to Dave's Gone By on WGBB.
I guess because of the Broadway background, that I think your voice has a quality that would work for both the pop and folk and folk rock idiom, and yet you have really stuck, so far as I can see, to the standards and Broadway-ish sort of itinerary. Am I off on that, or is that...
No, you are right. But lately, like with the last show that I created for the Okrum, I've expanded a little bit more. And in fact, I sing a Joan Baez song in my new show.
Uh-huh, which one?
So you're right on. I do feel that, too. I like...
Which by is?
Love Song to a Stranger.
Okay.
It's a later one that she wrote herself.
Cool. Well, yeah, well, she was writing her own stuff since Diamonds and Rust. But what have you, your record collection, either, let's say, 10 years ago or now, is it also mainly cast albums and you know, Susanna McCorkle and whatever, Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr., and Betty Buckley, or is it also everything from Joni Mitchell, Dylan, Nine Inch Nails, what have you?
Yes, everything. All those people are in my... I can't even say my record collection anymore. It's my iPod.
Your iPod?
But all in there. All my life I had very eclectic musical tastes.
So what are like three things in your iPod shuffle at the moment?
Let's see. What did I just listen to? I was just listening to Aretha Franklin.
Okay. Old or new?
Old.
Yeah.
Baby, Baby, Baby. That's the song I was listening to.
Mm-hmm.
I was listening to Bob Seger.
Okay.
And, and I listened to Alice Faye, Now It Can Be Told.
Alice Faye?
Yeah. So there you go. That's a pretty eclectic mix.
Yeah. Now, I guess also the follow-up question, or if you know Tom Stoppard's The Real Thing, you have three or four Desert Island Discs.
That is the toughest question.
Yes.
I think about this. Actually, that kind of question would keep me up at night because, Desert Island Discs.
Yeah.
That one is that's tough.
Hmm. So let's say you have a famous or a favorite song of all time.
Favorite song of all time.
I'm working on it.
Well, I was just talking with Jonathan Schwartz, and we agreed that All the Things You Are is maybe the most perfect song.
Like, because
song for written.
Why do you feel that?
Because it expresses its meaning so eloquently, really beautifully, and just exactly. I mean, the words are simple but so heartfelt, and just the construction of them and the way they line into the melody and the way the melody soars at the emotional height of the song.
Mm-hmm.
It's just you know what? There's something that is somewhat indescribable, as I think all good music has that quality, because I mean that's the reason why it's music, is because there aren't words to express what it is. All the Things You Are is a song where wherever you mention it, I at least two people, they sigh or they, oh, that song.
See, I do that to Boogie Oogie Oogie, so that's a little different for me there. But no, kidding. Now, when you did start to sing professionally in your mid-20s and stuff, you did have, at that point, you started getting some help and not quite doing it alone. So you were, would the phrase be fostered or mentored by Andrea Markovici and Michael Feinstein? Is that correct?
Yes, both.
How did they help? What did they do?
They shared their knowledge with me,
mm-hmm.
about their craft, and they shared their music libraries with me. They recommended music to me or things that I should just listen to. And they introduced me to their audiences. They had me come up as guest in their shows. Michael Feinstein did that for a whole month with me at Feinstein's at the Regency in 2001. Every night, every single show, he brought me up and introduced me and sang with me, and then I sang a song by myself.
Now, if you hadn't had that kind of push, and also the very, I wouldn't say overnight, but it was a pretty quick succession from being, Maude Maggart at Don't Tell Mama Who's That, to Maude Maggart, oh, you know who's sister, so what, to being, oh, Maude Maggart at the Oak Room, cool, let's go see her.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, within a couple of years. So, if that had not occurred, would you have tried the American Idol route or something like
never.
That?
No, not me.
Because of the shyness again, or why?
I think part of the reason why I was drawn to cabaret is that it's such a, you're very much in control of what you're doing, and you're not one of a herd of cattle looking to do the same thing, and mooing for that matter.
Did you do any actors stuff? Did you try out for, no interest in it?
Now I do. I think now I do. But no, I never did before. That's part of the reason why I like cabaret, is that it's, you can create your own career. You create your own job, you're your own boss, and the master of all that you convey.
Well, cabaret, and I've talked about this with Barry Levitt, who was the head of the Max for a while, and some other cabaret people, and it does tend to be the cyclical thing. Like a few years back, it seemed to be on a real downswing because clubs were closing and people didn't really know what was happening with it and if that kind of live music venue was really going to stick around.
Mm-hmm.
Or sort of morph into something else. Has it taken an upswing because maybe so many regional theaters now have cabaret rooms and things like that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that places recognize that, a cabaret is so small that you can never, a business can't really think of it as a gigantic moneymaker. But it is something that, if people know that it's out there, it's a highly desirable way to spend your evening, you know what I mean? So there will always be people filling the rooms.
Well, hopefully.
Yeah. No, well, I mean, as long as you have good entertainment in a room, I think that the allure of that kind of old world romance. You know, I mean, it's like sophisticated dating. It's to go to a cabaret with a date is to participate in the art of dating, I think, you know.
Okay. Well, okay. Since you brought that up, let's turn to the personal stuff. Are you you're not married, but are you dating? Are you?
Oh yeah, sure. Yeah.
Okay. Anybody seriously or special or what or what?
Yes.
Oh. And is there like an engagement thingy or not to that point?
No, not to that point.
Cool. We'll just leave that there.
Hi, this is former shy girl Maud Maggart, and you're listening to Dave's Gone By on WGBB.
We're talking with Maud Maggart, the lovely and incredibly talented and beautiful voiced cabaret singer. Were there points when there were songs that you really wanted to tackle, and you realized or thought or felt that your voice wouldn't be right for them?
Well, no, because I can pretty much tell immediately whether or not my voice is going to be right. So I never want to tackle. Yeah, I mean, I would like to be Janis Joplin sometimes, you know, but that's never going to
happen. You blow your voice out in one day, you'll never sing again.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't even, look, I mean, when I've been all by my lonesome, I've tried it, and it's awful. So, you know, I know where that territory is. So, you know, in that case, I am perfectly content to just enjoy the music and not try to participate in it. So, no, I mean, the music that I'm drawn to sing, I'm drawn to sing it because I feel like I have a shot at doing it some justice.
Can you think of, like, one or two of two moments when you were performing in a particular night or club or event or benefit that everything just sort of came together? It was one of those moments where, like, oh, this is why I'm doing this. I love this.
Yeah.
I will remember this moment forever kind of moment.
Oh, well, there's a feeling that happens where you feel the magic, the joyful magic of live performance, where your voice is coming together with some music, and there's like an energetic flow with the audience and yourself and the music and your musicians, and everything is like everybody feels like this is the best place they could ever be, and you feel it, and those are magic moments that come and go, you know.
Any recent ones that you could, like within the past year, let's say that?
Sure. Well, I mean, there have been certain performances at the Oak Room where I certainly felt that at the Algonquin.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't remember one in particular. Oh, well, let's see. I do remember I was on a Prairie Home Companion twice.
Oh, that's neat.
Yeah. At Town Hall, and then after that I performed at the Hollywood Bowl in Hollywood.
Nice.
Yeah, and I I had the audacity to sing Over the Rainbow, if you can believe it, right after, and I had no idea he was going to do this, but Garrison Keillor, he was introducing me, and he gave this introduction, and he explained how Judy Garland had sat on that very stage in 1961, I think, and sung Over the Rainbow, and I thought, oh, God, what the hell? What am I going to do now? You know, it was like spelling out the audacity. But it turned out to not be that. It was, I remember the moment, you know. I didn't sit on the end of the edge of the stage, but I did look out into the expanse of that bowl, and just the wind was blowing in the exact right direction. And it was quite memorable. I'll remember that forever. Hi, this is Maud Maggart. Oh, wait. I don't know what to say now.
What do you do when you get a cold and you still have to go out there and do it?
My father calls it Dr. Theater that comes to visit you, which does not mean, like, Dr. Feelgood.
Well, I wonder. Colonel Parker? Anyone? No, no.
you're familiar with Dr. Theater. It's just, you know, you're...
The second you go on stage, something happens.
Yeah, something happens. I don't know if it's your adrenaline or just your drive to... I mean, there's nothing worse than being a singer and stepping out on stage and feeling like your instrument that you rely on is not going to come through for you. I mean, that leaves you completely naked and vulnerable to make a fool out of yourself. So Dr. Theater has served me very well. I had to, for the first time in my life, I had to cancel a show. Recently I was in London, and I came down with laryngitis, and I couldn't even make a sound.
Yikes.
So that was, you know, what do you do? You can't do anything. So in that case, I canceled the show.
And how long did it take for you to get your voice back, not just back, but in singable condition?
Well, I just did a concert a couple of days ago, and it was pretty much all the way back. But that was the space of about a week and a half.
Now, going into a concert when you're just coming back from something like that, do you make compensations? Do you realize, like, a high note's going to be coming in, and do you either take it an octave lower or do a lot of arm motions so people don't notice that it's a little weak on the attack, or what?
Yeah, I hide behind the piano when the high note's coming. Pay no attention to that woman behind the piano.
You just flash the audience at that moment. the high C's coming. It's right. Like, boom, open goes the shirt, and then you're off to the next note. And
right.
Nobody notices. It's great.
No, well, sure. I mean, yeah, you have to compensate. And for me, it's interesting because I become much more, I think the dramatic side comes out much more for me, more interpretive. When Andrea Markovich has had vocal trouble, she's done this thing that's, it's like a half a Sprecht thing, like, you know, half between talking and singing.
Oh.
And she's such a marvelous actress that it's like you don't even notice, you know, that that she's not technically singing every note. But that's, you know, that's when she's been very ill.
Yeah.
But sure, if I know a high note's coming and I know it's not going to come out, then of course, you know, I'll take it an octave lower or just change. You know, you have to. I mean, you don't want to go for it and then croak.
Well, no. Literally or figuratively, depending how sick you are. We are talking, by the way, with Maud Maggart, the singer. And I should mention, first of all, that you have a new CD out, which we've been playing from on the program. It's called Maud Maggart Live. And as it happened, just so happens to be an appropriate title because it's a live recording there. Where was the Algonquin Oak Room? All the songs were done there.
No, actually, about half the songs were recorded at the Algonquin, and half the songs were recorded at the Gardenia in West Hollywood.
Oh, okay, so that's why it's got three different logos on the back of the CD.
Right, and there's one track that was recorded in New York at this past summer's River to River festival.
Cool. And just so people know, some of the songs on the disc include Coffee in the Morning, Kisses in the Night. You've got Deep in a Dream, Deep Purple, I Can't Get Started, I'm in the Mood for Love, My Funny Valentine. I mean, you're doing the majors here now. You know, not obscurities. You're taking on some songs that have real mileage on them.
Part of the fun of concentrating on music from the American Popular Songbook is it's really fun to create an evening or an album in which you can resurrect or unearth songs that some people have forgotten about or some people didn't even know exist because they're old, you know, they've been around for a long time. And unless it's a song like I'm in the Mood for Love or My Funny Valentine, you know, those songs, everybody knows.
And even some of those, people only know the first verse.
Right.
Or the first two lines,
right.
And it's like, oh, wait, there's two other verses in the bridge and a chorus. I didn't know those.
Right.
So, I mean,
yeah. And the fact remains that, you know, it's they're gorgeous songs. I mean, they're so popular and still alive, you know, beating in the hearts of so many people because they're beautiful. And so it serves both myself and the audience to give them something that they recognize and love, and that I recognize and love too. You know, so I like to create a mixture of songs that are somewhat unearthed, people might not know, but then also give them, you know, what they're waiting for.
Do you feel like your style has changed in the past 6 or 7 years from when you first started, and how?
Well, I think I'm more of a woman now.
Well. Hey, yeah.
I was a little boy before.
I doubt that highly, but okay, yeah.
No, I just...
For evidence, go to maudmaggart.com, by the way.
Right.
Should give that website out, and it's Maggart, maudmaggart.com.
Yes, pronounced beautifully by yourself, Dave, if I do say so.
Well, thank you so much. Actually, I'm stealing from Ray Jessel, because he's very clear on his CD
yes.
of the enunciation, because if you say Maggart, People will think, like, you know, the fly with a T on the end. And
I know.
Yeah.
I know.
So.
I know. All my life I thought, oh, I'm destined to be fly larva. That's in my life.
Well, I assume you don't get that anymore.
Oh, you're kidding. Of course I do. Sure I do.
Oh dear.
Yeah.
Now here, now forgive me, and again, if you really don't want to go there, we don't have to go there, but I do think people would be interested in the other aspect of your family, which is the sister.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Cool, okay, because, you know, you have a sister who was famous before you became famous.
Mm-hmm.
So she's older-ish or younger-ish or...
Yes, she's about 2.5 years younger than I am.
Younger, cool. And so she... I take it you shared record collections to some extent, but she certainly went in a different direction.
Yeah, well, my sister is Fiona Apple.
Right.
Great songwriter and singer. Yeah, we did. We enjoyed most of the same music, I have to say, growing up. And we went in different directions, but that's because she's been a songwriter all her life, and a really good songwriter.
So she would do something like when she was 9 or 10 years old, and she'd play it for you, and would you give her comments? Would you just stare in awe at your younger sister? Or,
yeah, just stare in awe. I mean, you can't mess with, you know.
I assume she was taking
piano. I mean,
piano,
from the time she was 6 years old, she was writing beautiful.
Oh, my gosh. And your voices are so different, because yours is this lovely, lilting high soprano. Well, not that high, but it's a very, angelic kind of soprano. And she goes more for this bass, heavy, resonant voice.
Mm-hmm.
It's like this dominatrix, come here sort of voice. Well, I don't know. Hey, you're the one dressed in sexy red on the back of your CD. I'm just trying to sell CDs here. but so when she became sort of an overnight-ish success, that did sort of happen for her, thanks to MTV and all that, was... there a strain, or was the family kind of used to it because they were in showbiz? Was there jealousy? Was there just, oh, wow, my sister's so famous? How did that all...
Well, I mean, it was a new experience for... I mean, my parents were in show business, but nobody, none of us had achieved the kind of, like, instant massive fame and success that she did. So we were all so proud of her. But she was so young. I mean, she was 18.
Oh, wow.
When she, you know, became famous started to go on tour, and you know, she was young, and so I think we all were just wanted her to be okay. I mean, that's rough on anybody to get
to achieve that kind of
success and fame. But then when you're so young and very, you know, obviously sensitive and you know, and vulnerable, and I'm a big sister, so I worried, but she handled it beautifully.
Was she able, did she turn to the family? Did she call you from, especially when time, there was that period when she was going through a really tough public time. Or maybe it was only like a bad night, and then because the media was there, it became like a bad year.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas she might have, you know, 2 days later, she would have said, oh, God, what a bad night. Well, I'm fine. Or was it a bad time?
Well, I mean, there were, I guess, a few kind of, you know, difficult moments. But, yeah, sure, she turned to me. We're very close. Actually, we turn to each other a lot more now.
Cool.
And I think that, you know, my sister's been extremely resilient and strong person. And I think that part of that is feeling like she trusts herself to heal herself. You know, she's been hurt. Or something like that, and to not immediately, you know, throw your arms out and somebody hold me and take care of me, you know, and love me. So, I mean, there is, of course, some of that. I mean, she's a human being, but
but she's not throwing her arms out to drugs or something. She's throwing her arms out to people, which is what you're supposed to do.
Right.
People in television and you know, a beer at the end of the day or something. But what are some of the advice that she gave you and you gave her on career stuff?
Well, I don't think I ever gave her any advice on career stuff. I rarely give her advice. And actually...
You're the big sis.
Yeah, but I have a tremendous amount of faith in her own judgment. And, I mean, if she solicits advice from me, then I'm right there to give it. But you know, yeah. The same thing with me. Like part of the satisfaction of feeling like you can, like you're strong and you can find out the answers and take care of yourself is actually being put to the test and accomplishing it, you know. Let's see. The only advice she ever gave me was, I called her once and I was very excited about a good review that I had gotten. And mm-hmm. she said, that's great. She said, you know, but I have to tell you that, fine, you know, enjoy it, but if you put a lot of stock in a good review, you're going to have to pay as much attention to a bad review if you get one.
Yeah.
That was extremely wise, you know.
Oh, yeah. I've been a theater critic for about 20 years, so I've heard that banding about. And it is actually true. It's one person's opinion.
Right.
And if you say, oh, God, yes, they got it. They understand me. They love me. And then the next show, they have the total opposite review. If you put all those eggs in that basket, they're all going to smash.
Exactly. So that's the sort of take it with a grain of salt advice, which I now absolutely do.
What would you say is your greatest hurdle that you had to get over?
My greatest hurdle that I had to get over, that was, I suppose feeling, authoritative and like I deserve to be, you know, sometimes there is a vast age difference between myself and my audience. I mean, it's usually a big mixture of people my age, younger, and people certainly who are significantly older than I am.
Right.
Because
cabaret audience.
I sing, the music of a generation that that is older than I am,
right?
For the most part. So, a big hurdle for me was feeling like they weren't looking at me like, who is this little kid thinking that she knows what our music is?
Hmm.
You know, and speaking with authority and reverence about the material that I was, since I didn't live through it. You know, I mean, I didn't. When I was a kid, I didn't turn on the radio and the hit song of the day was Smoke It's in Your Eyes. You know, I mean, that never happened to me. All I can do is imagine what it was like. And the music affects me, I'm certain, as deeply as it affected people who actually lived through it. But there is a generational gap. But it's one of those simple things that is very difficult to discover, you know. It's like the simplest truth that is at the end of a labyrinth. Of you know, self-doubt and second-guessing and stuff. But the simple truth is that it doesn't matter how old you are or where you come from. The songs that touch people's hearts are songs that express what it's like to be human. They express human emotion. And my grandmother went through probably everything that I've gone through emotionally.
Hmm.
And so just because there's a generational difference, there is such a strong thread connecting generations because we all have experienced the same emotions. You know, the circumstances may have been different, but, you know, there it is right there. And that, to me, was revelatory to realize that that's how I cannot feel like a stupid little kid. I'm the same as they are.
Well, you're very, very far from a stupid little kid.
Thank you.
That should be the blurb on your next album.
Far from a stupid kid.
Yeah, very far from stupid kid. And you can put all your eggs in that basket, absolutely.
That's right. I will put all my eggs in that basket.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's been great, great fun and a delight to talk to Maud Maggart. Go get her CD, Maud Maggart Live. Plus, she has a couple of others. I assume they're all available at your website, maudmaggart.com.
Yes, I think they are now, and maudmaggart.com and amazon.com.
Cool. And the usual, typical final question is, A, what are your upcoming plans for the next couple of weeks, I mean, as far as doing stuff in New York, and B, some of the longer-range plans as far as your next CD or you know, next tour or something like that?
Well, I'm going to be at the 92nd Street Y, in June, I think June 2nd to 4th, with Steve Ross. I'm going to be in a show about Noel Coward.
Oh, Steve Ross is so great.
I love Steve Ross,
yeah.
So I'll be there then. And, on May 30th, I'm doing an in-store performance at Barnes & Noble at Lincoln Center.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Cool. And what about...
I'll be there signing the CD and performing.
signing the CD or pretty much any CD that people want to pick up. So, well, of yours. Don't go there and buy a Nine Inch Nails CD and expect Moa to sign it.
Hey, I'll sign it.
Well, that's nice of you.
Reznor might get angry at me, but, you know.
Sign it, Trent. But, and what about more long-range-ish? Just more of the same?
No, I mean, yeah, I'll always perform songs from the American Popular Songbook, but, you know, I like the way life changes and become interested in new things, so who knows. But I will be back at the Okrum at the Algonquin next year.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So it's over a year that we have to wait, but for 6 weeks, beginning April 1st.
April 1st of 2008.
Eight.
Wow. Now, that's the great thing about, you know, being where you are already in your career. You're booking for a year or so in advance at a place like the Oak Room. That's mm-hmm. neat. So much, many, many years of continued success and really lovely, lovely music. And absolutely delightful talking to you, Maud Maggart. Thanks so much for being in the neighborhood.
Thank you, Dave.